accession number 27767, Reel 2.
Adrian Holloway, Reel 2.
We left Cape Town with great sadness after 3 days there, which we thoroughly enjoyed. John Cardew and I went up Table Mountain. We went to see the Prime Minister's residence, Grutus Kure, and did the sights as any tourist would do. And so we were very sorry indeed to leave. We then went up the east coast of Africa, called in at Durban to refuel, but were not allowed ashore. Later on, I was to know Durban very well indeed, because my cruise of the Suffolk in 1943 went there for a three-month refit, and it was rather like the Bounty going to Tahiti. It was absolutely wonderful. Well, then we went on up the coast, and we got to the Horn of Africa, and for the first time in our lives, we were bombed by a lone Italian aircraft. But the bomb dropped harmlessly and nothing else happened.
Had you any idea where you were going?
No, we hadn't. And then we went up the Red Sea, which, of course, as its name implies, was extremely hot. But since the Dominion Monarch had been constructed for tropical waters, it was fine. I don't think we had air conditioning, but the ship was pretty cool. Those who were in the transatlantic liners, like the Britannic and so on, it was pretty fair hell for them, because they were not constructed for that sort of climate. Then we reached Port Tewfik, which is another name for Suez. And Admiral Crichton signaled to me, "Hope you have a good time goodbye," from the Commodore's ship, which was very nice. And we were transferred to a train, which we knew then was to take us to Alexandria. And there it was quite amusing, because we had to change place, had to change trains at a large junction just south of Cairo called Zagazig, and it was a pretty flyburn, awful place. And one of my term had decided that since we were all wearing immaculate whites at that time, it would be better to put on our pajamas over the whites so that they wouldn't get dirty in the dusty train. And so that when we detrained at Zagazig, it made us look rather like concentration camp inmates. So we got to Alexandria. It was raining, it was dark, there was a blackout, and there was bombing, which was not a good introduction. And then we were all sent off in picket boats, and I was told that I would be taken off the picket boat, John Cardew and I and some others, to the battleship Valiant. I said, "But I'm a Kent midshipman." "Oh, no, you're not," they said. "Kent was torpedoed recently, and so you're now a Valiant midshipman." And that was really, I think, the very best thing that could have happened to me, because Valiant was an extremely happy ship. She was quite wonderful. Her captain had been Captain Rawlings, who later became an admiral. Her commander was Commander Reed, whose father had been surgeon to Queen Victoria. And between them, they made a wonderful team and made it a very happy ship. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we went from the picket boat and were met by a midshipman who we'd known at Dartmouth called David Peck. And he said, "Follow me." And we went down lighted corridors and so on, until he flung open a curtain and said, "Here you are," and this was the gunroom. And the gunroom was a place where midshipmen lived most of their time, and it was a place that was commanded by a sub-lieutenant. He was sub-lieutenant the Honourable Terence Stopford, the Earl of Courtown's son, and an extremely nice man, but he was our Lord and Master for the next 18 months.
Could you give me his name again? Sorry.
Terence Stopford, the Honourable Terence Stopford.
What sort of a chap was he? I mean, he was the one who had to sort of introduce you to life on board, didn't he?
Well, he wouldn't have demeaned himself to do that. You see, there was it was really rather prestigious because the almost senior midshipman was Terry Lewin. Now, Terry Lewin was a quite wonderful chap. He later on became Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Lewin, and was Chief of the Defence Staff at the time of the Falklands, on whom Mrs. Thatcher relied very much. And it was he who showed us round everything and so on. I mean, he was practically a lieutenant, although only a midshipman. I mean, he was so very, very good and very nice with it. Because before the war, senior midshipmen could have given junior midshipmen hell. They did, very often. And there were all sorts of ghastly rituals you had to undergo. And he said, I stopped all that nonsense. It was not going to do that. So the gunroom, as I say, had banquette seats along the outboard side, and very often if you hadn't got anywhere to sleep, you slept on those. You see, midshipmen had no cabins. They, if you were lucky, you got a camp bed, and you had a sort of sea chest to keep all your clothes in and so on. You could put the odd photograph up on top. But people would be coming backwards and forwards all the time. You were so tired very often that it didn't make much difference. I've slept sometimes through air raids when the guns were actually firing in our ship, and it never woke me. So, you know. So but
what were your daily duties
then? Today, of course, there are no midshipmen, at least I don't think so. But in those days, you had either a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander who was appointed as what was called the snotty's nurse. Now, a snotty, you see, was another name for a midshipman, and it derived from the three buttons on your sleeve, and they had been put there in the 18th century to deter the revolting habit that midshipmen would have of wiping their noses on their sleeve. So your nose is snotty. And always address, snotty, come here, and so on. Never a midshipman. And so who had the snotty's nurse? And our snotty's nurse was Lieutenant Commander Michael Penton, who was the navigating officer. And he was a rather slow, ponderous man, always smoking a pipe, as most navigators did, probably brushing hot ashes off the chart. But he was very, very nice to us. He saw that we learnt everything about the ship. We were given a tour of the ship, you know, to the ivory compartment, because it was it was honeycombed with it. But we had to draw up a plan of all three decks, and that concentrated the mind. And we did every single job that there ever was to be done. For instance, just before the Battle of Matapan, which took place in March 1941, I had been given charge of the searchlights. And 2 weeks later, at the actual battle, I was relieved by Prince Philip, who had by that time joined us. Anyway, that's a digression. But you were roused at about 6:30, and then you were given BT on the quarterdeck, had to endure the smirks of the sailors who were washing the decks at the time. They were delighted to see you jumping about and so on. Then you had breakfast, and there were a myriad amount of duties. One of the best ones was to run a boat. Valiant had two beautiful picket boats. Valiant had two picket boats, which were beautiful, fast launches, really, and they were used for taking officers ashore and making runs around the harbour. Now, originally they had a Rolls-Royce Merlin aero engine in it, and could do 25 to 30 knots, and of course it was a disgraceful waste of such a lovely engine which ought to have been the Spitfire. So they were taken out and replaced with Ford V8s. But to be the midshipman in charge of one of these boats was the greatest fun. You had a crew of the coxswain, who was beside you and was really your first lieutenant, a stern sheetman who had a boat hook in the stern. There was a stoker who ran the engine and a bowman. And you had the engine revving at the gangway steps. And then when everybody was on board, you'd pull back the throttle. There'd be a slight gurgle and you'd go astern. And then you'd put the throttles forward and dash around the harbour, trying to avoid all the immense amount of traffic that there was there. And, of course, if you crashed your boat and it had to be hoisted in for repair, that meant that some officers couldn't go ashore and your leave was most certainly stopped. I ran the launch, which was a 45-foot boat, and that was used for taking liberty men ashore, the sailors who were allowed to go on leave for that afternoon, evening. And that had the most extraordinary way of method of propulsion. You never went astern in it. What happened was that it had two flanged metal cups which could be operated from the tiller, and you wound a wheel to get them either to open or to close. Now, when they were open, the flow of water, of course, would go straight through and the boat would go ahead. When you closed them, due to some extraordinary thing which I've never understood to this day, the boat would go astern, although the propeller was still going forward. And it made it wonderfully manoeuvrable, because if you put the helm over to the starboard or to the right, your stern would go in that way. So if in order to get to a very difficult place, say a jetty, which was rather narrow, you pointed the boat at 45 degrees, went astern, spun the stern in, and there you were, right next to the best bit of parking I've ever known. It was called a kitchen rudder, and I have never seen it before or since, but it was very, very interesting and wonderfully manoeuvrable. So we used to take liberty men and so on ashore, and every time the boat's crew was called away in the 24 hours, you had to go with it, or you were punished. You got to listen for the pipe, which came over the loudspeaker system. Away launches crew, and then you had to go. Before the war, a midshipman was wearing a dirk, a little sword behind, and he had possibly to crawl across the boom to which the launch was attached and go down by a little rope ladder. And, of course, very often the wretched dirk got in his way and he probably fell in. It was too frightful. And at one time I wanted to get on board quickly, and the launch had been carrying potatoes which the crane had been hauling in, so I just attached myself to the crane and got holding on the cable. We did, as I say, every single job there was possible. Somebody would be attached to the navigator as what was called the navigator's doggy. And the captain's doggy, you did everything. You went around with them and did any errands that were had to be done. You were also a midshipman of the watch, rather important, really. You went in full uniform on the quarterdeck for a four-hour watch in harbour, of course, with a telescope under your arm, and you were the doggy, more or less, of the officer of the watch. And if, say, the commander-in-chief's picket boat was seen in some part of the harbour and he was going to cross your bows, he'd be wearing a pennant which either said yes or no. If it was yes, you had to get the bugler to sound off the alert and everybody had to stand to attention and salute. And if you missed that, then there was punishment also. We did had to go down into one of the wireless rooms and receive Morse through earphones from one of the telegraphists. I was absolutely hopeless at it and could never understand what was going through the earphones at all. As I say, we did engineering as well, which was extremely interesting from the point of view of really going down into engine rooms and boiler rooms and so on. Then, of course, you became midshipman of the turret. Valiant had her main armor were four huge turrets of 15-inch guns, which would they were the main armament, and you had to assist the officer of the turret, or were there really for training more. There was nothing you could do to assist him by sitting in this inside of the turret, which was like being really in what you might call a Martian operating theatre. The whole thing was steel, and from below, when you were firing, an enormous cage, steel cage, would come up all automatically, and first would go in, the breech would be opened automatically, air would be injected through it to put out any smoke that had been there. The shell, a huge, great 15-inch shell, would be pushed in by a ram, and then a cordite charge that would follow. The breech would shut, and it would be locked, and then a ready light would come on to indicate to the director tower way up above the bridge that the guns were ready. So being in that always fascinated me, because there was so much noise going on. As I say, I likened it to a Martian operating theatre.
It's all right. So I wondered, did you get much contact with the officers, or were you? Did they treat you as a separate species, or?
No, on the whole, they were very nice indeed in Valiant. The commander was delightful. Part of the duty at sea was to call either the captain or commander, and you must never, never, never shake them, because that was regarded almost as an assault and highly punishable. But if I went in to Commander Reed and called him, he would say, "Thank you, Holloway," and you would at once who'd been there. Unfortunately, one midshipman was rather naughty. He got in great trouble with the captain, because the captain never leaves the bridge. He has a sea cabin below the bridge to which he goes, and so he can be on the bridge in seconds. And there was a voice pipe leading down to it. And one of my friends, there were many voice pipes coming up through into the bridge. He thought that this voice pipe led to the plot in which another of his midshipman friends was. So he poured some hot cocoa down it, but it actually went onto the captain's face, which wasn't very... now, where do you want?
Yeah, so you had all these different duties. Did you spend most of your time then with the launch? Was that your sort of number one job?
Yes, that was.
Then you did other things.
But you see, I was midshipman of the turret, in B turret, the second foremost turret. And you literally did every job that there was. Officer, if you were midshipman of the watch, at sea in wartime, of course, everybody zigzagged. And we did something called zigzag number 10, which you had what was called the main line of advance, which was the actual course. And then every so often, You would go to port or starboard of the mean line of advance, 22.5 degrees and 10.5 degrees, and then 22.5 degrees the other way. And it was the midshipman's duty to watch the clock most minutely and then tell the officer of the watch that it was time to alter course, because everybody had to do it at the same time. And this, can I digress slightly from Valiant? Involved me in the most awful thing of my life. I was in the cruiser Suffolk as a sub-lieutenant. And I was officer of the watch, not midshipman of the watch, but officer of the watch. And it was a dark night in a convoy in the Indian Ocean. And somebody once said that war is mostly boredom. Well, that may be so. But I was talking to the principal control officer, who was an officer senior to me, who was to work the guns there. And we were both was rather bored, and I thought I knew this zigzag, which was number 10, which we'd used in the Mediterranean a great deal. And I thought I knew it off by heart. Well, I gave the order port 10, and the ship compass, you could see, was beginning to click away to port. And then, fortunately, I had a friend who'd been at Dartmouth with me, and he was down in the plot below, keeping a plot of the ship's course. And suddenly came up the voice pipe. I say, sub, that was for sub-lieutenant, aren't you going the wrong way? And I looked, and I could see the Commodore's ship coming towards us instead of going away. And it was one of the worst moments of my life. The officer in charge of the whole bridge ordered the helm to be put over right over to starboard. I put on some extra revs. But, of course, when you've got one cruiser of 10,000 tons and the Commodore's ship was 30,000 tons, they don't turn very quickly. And I literally, the term on leaden feet was comparable to that case. And it was too awful. Well, we averted a collision, just. And what was, again, rather awful was I didn't tell the captain, because, to be honest, I thought that the officer senior to me would do so. And then a messenger the next morning arrived at my cabin and said, "Sir, the captain wishes to see you." And he stood there and handed me a signal which had come from the Commodore, which said, "Why did you commit unfriendly act in the middle of the night and try to ram me?" And so, of course, I was torn off a complete strip, which I thoroughly deserved. But it taught me one thing, that you should never, never do things of your own. If it's an intricate thing, you must check it. Sorry, digress. So, can you stop it a moment?
Yes, certainly.
To go back to our first morning on the quarterdeck when we were in Alexandria, I looked round the harbour, which was a beautiful harbour, and there was the British Mediterranean fleet in all its glory, with three battleships, a rather aged aircraft carrier, the Eagle, and Illustrious, the more modern carrier. But what fascinated and rather appalled me was an ancient battleship, three beautiful cruisers and eight destroyers, and these were the French Mediterranean fleet, which of course had been immobilized at the surrender of France in June 1940. Apparently what had taken place was that Admiral Godefroy, the commander-in-chief of the French fleet, had been quite friendly with Admiral Cunningham, who was our commander-in-chief. But the negotiations for their surrender were protracted and very difficult. Cunningham had an officer on his staff who spoke very good French, and he was the go-between them all. But it must have been very difficult for the French, who were proud, who had to, first of all, say that they weren't going to join us, and secondly, to be immobilized by us. We took away the breech blocks of their guns, which meant that they couldn't fire. We only gave them sufficient fuel in order to heat the ship and not to go to sea. And there you would see the French Vichy sailors ashore in all their uniforms with their red pom-poms and Breton jerseys and so on, enjoying themselves and doing damn all to help the war.
And that is something that you noticed with some dismay by the
sound. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because they were, the old cruiser, the old battleship Lorraine, she wouldn't have been much good. She was built in about 1912. But there was the cruiser Duc Etoin, Toulon, and one other whose name I can't remember. And they were beautiful ones, which would have been such a help to us, especially at the time of Crete.
Yeah, so you were risking your lives.
Yeah, well, they were doing nothing.
So your first trip out of Alexandria on Valiant, yeah, then, were you quite excited? I mean, this was suddenly you were actually in the war, weren't you?
Oh, yes, it was, because in all innocence, we didn't know what it was like. And so it was, of course. And let's face it, you felt certainly certainly safer in a 30,000-ton battleship than you would, say, in a 1,500-ton destroyer. Although that actually, when Barham, the battleship, our sister ship, was torpedoed in front of us, was actually no safeguard whatsoever. She sank in 5 minutes. But it gave you a feeling of that you were in a powerful ship and that she was almost invincible, which, of course, was a fool's paradise. Anyway, later on...
So from Alexandria, where did you go to initially?
There was nothing much doing between October 1940 and... Oh, yes, of course. Yes, our first operation was to be part of the escorting force for the aircraft carrier Illustrious to send her aircraft to bomb Taranto. And we went up to within about 100 miles of Taranto, and then just as it was getting dark, Illustrious flew off her Swordfish aircraft, each equipped with a torpedo. And of course, Taranto has been very much in the history books. It's celebrated at the Fleet Arm base of Yeovilton in Somerset every year. And it was the most wonderfully successful operation. The Swordfish went in spite of tremendous anti-aircraft fire, and they disabled two battleships, and I think it was two cruisers. And at the time, it was regarded as a very great victory, because rather naturally, it helped the balance of sea power in the favour of the British.
And what was it like for you in that situation? I mean, did you have much of an idea what was actually going to happen? Were you told what the plan was?
The commander was very good in that sort of thing. He always kept us informed by coming over the public address system and saying what was projected as far as he could. Obviously, he would never do that until we'd left harbour because of a security leak. But he would say, now we've proposed that the aircraft from Illustrious flies off and they're going to Taranto, and we're a covering force just in case the rest of the Italian Navy should come out. So that was very good. And later on, when the pilots made the report to the captain and so on, the news was flashed as to what damage they'd done. But an interesting offshoot of this, you see, is that there was a certain Japanese commander called Genda, who at that time was serving as Japanese military attaché, naval attaché in London, because, of course, we were not at war with Japan then. And he was an aviator, and he took very, very great interest in that, and that is really the forerunner of what happened at Pearl Harbor, our attack on Taranto. So we came back, and there was much rejoicing and so on. I don't think we lost a single ship, and I think only about two aircraft were lost. The old Swordfish, which were known as the Stringbags, were an incredible aircraft. They could probably do at least 90 miles an hour in a following wind. And but they were so manoeuvrable, and nobody could believe that they could fly so slowly and so low. And that's why they were ideal for torpedo attack.
I'll stop you just there. Adrian Holloway, end of reel 2.
Oh, my God, have I reached that?